actually found the notes useful.
The notes are useful, I think, but the recording, yeah, I don't know.
Sometimes it works, sometimes it
Yeah. I think that's at least my opinion, the notes is useful. The recording is somewhat marginal. I mean, if you can't be here, probably the recording is useful. But to actually go back and listen to it, it's kind of painful. I don't know. I need to do more little video things. I haven't yet solved that issue, but I think that those things might be more useful than that.
I might have missed you.
I missed you too.
So anyway, this quarter the lab is a project, and I've been talking with Steve Heinel, and he had suggested we could do some things that, you know, would have been interesting for him, and also it seemed like an interesting project. But in order to do those, I needed to get some FPGA development boards from Altera. And, you know, I asked a couple of weeks ago for those, you know, whether I could get boards from them, whether they would give us boards, and I got a nice, you know, automated reply. It says, you know, you'll hear back within 2 weeks, and haven't heard back yet, so I don't know whether we'll get any of those. And it's a bit expensive to do if we're going to buy a bunch of boards ourselves, in addition to all the other parts we're going to get, too. So I'm still kind of thinking about that. In the past, we've done a different kind of software-defined radio. The one that Steve kind of wants us to work on is one that has an A to D converter that's fast. You know, it will sample at more than twice the highest frequency you're going to receive. And then you have to use an FPGA to take that data because it's coming so fast. You know, if you're sampling at say maybe 80 megahertz or something, and you're sampling at, you know, 12-bit A to D or something, that's a lot of bits per second. You know, it's just, it'll pretty much choke you. And, you know, the actual data coming out of the receiver is not anything near that. So part of the receiver has to be done in the digital world, in the FPGA, and then, you know, you usually send that over Ethernet or something to a computer that displays the data and, you know, puts out the audio and does the, you know, demodulation and so on. And the thing that Steve would like to see is, you know, compare some different analog to digital converters and see how well they work, you know. You know, if that doesn't work, then the other way that I've done it in the past, which is a much cheaper way to do it, because you don't have to have a fancy FPGA. FPGAs are pretty expensive. And what you do is you just have an analog down converter, which just converts the frequency from a higher frequency down to audio, and then you use your computer sound card as your analog to digital converter. And there's more analog components then to do it, which, you know, in some ways I kind of like, because, you know, this class is more of an analog kind of a class than a digital kind of a class. The next class you take in electronics is digital design, and then you'll do a bunch of FPGA stuff, and, you know. So we'll see what happens. I'll give them another few days before I decide what I'm going to do. The other thing is, if you guys have any brilliant ideas or cool things that you'd really like to work on, you know, I'm kind of open to suggestions at this point, too. So, if you have some interesting ideas, we could, you know, think about those kind of things, too. Nowadays, what happens is a lot of electronic stuff has a little chunk of analog electronics and whatnot, and then there's a whole bunch of either software or, you know, software kind of quasi software FPGA kind of stuff, and maybe someday we ought to think about revising our curriculum a little bit, so that we could integrate those kind of things more instead of having them kind of separated. Now, in the past, I've tried to get Kurt, when he taught embedded, to work with me on like a software-defined radio. So we'd do the analog part in electronics, and then in embedded, you know, you could do the computer part, little microcontroller and whatnot.
They had a second class that just did software for embedded systems.
Yeah, you never get enough. So anyway, that's kind of where we are. I'm not sure I'll give you a homework today, but if I come up think of something good, maybe I'll stick something up there. That's why I put that up there. What I want to do first is I just want to show you how an AM radio works, and several different types of AM radios. And the reason you need to know this is, well, first of all, if we're going to do the project, then you're going to send us a radio, then you need to know how a radio receiver works. Second of all, it gives you a good introduction on how analog signal processing has been done in the past, okay? And analog signal processing is still done somewhat, and it's done in cases where the digital stuff is not fast enough, okay? So that's one case. And that would be kind of in the case, thought about this software-defined radio, you couldn't afford the FPGA and the really fast A to D converter. Well, then you can do it with this cheap way of doing things, just down convert everything in analog signal processing and then do it, in a cheap, A to D and, like it's built into your computer and whatnot. And so that's one reason. But it's done less and less. Okay, it's done less and less. But it used to be kind of the bread and butter of electrical engineers. I mean, that was the thing. Electrical engineers were really expert analog signal processing people, And they used to do feedback and control systems that way. They used to do all kinds of stuff. Everything was that way. And there are still cases where people do that kind of thing. Like, say, for example, some of you guys, well, no, you're juniors, so you might not have been in the design reviews. And the design reviews for the seniors this year, let's see, who was it? Somebody was doing a thing for Key Technologies, and they have a shaker table where there's two motors that are fed in parallel. Okay, so you have two AC motors fed in parallel, and on the shaft of each of these motors is a unbalanced object, not a cylindrical thing, something that's unbalanced, okay? And they're each, kind of, this one is half unbalanced this way and that's half unbalanced the other way. So, these things, they're heavier on one side than the other, so when you stop, they both end up down on the bottom. But then when you turn on the motor, then there's a really big jump at the beginning, when the thing starts to get going, because after a while, what will happen is, since these two motors are fed in parallel, the one heaviness will be on the opposite side of the heaviness of the other motor. And it minimizes the vibrations that way, but there's still vibrations, and this is a shaker table, so they want vibrations, but they don't like that big jump at the beginning. So, one way to do this, of course, would be a little microprocessor that starts this motor before that motor, and, does it just right? Well, the guys at Key Technology didn't want to do that because it was a little bit more expensive and a little bit more complicated than, just a simple, analog kind of delay circuit, RC kind of delay circuit. So they did an analog RC delay circuit. It's a very simple circuit, and, it does what's needed.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And, that's what this person was doing for their senior project, working on that. And it looked good to me. So there are times when a simple analog circuit can, certainly it's doing the same things you could do with a microprocessor, right? But it's much simpler, And so we still do those kind of things sometimes. But it's not as much as in the past. Nevertheless, you whether you're doing analog or digital signal processing, you need to do the signal processing. And the signal processing is actually making, taking a signal coming in. Next quarter you'll take a class in signals and systems, or some of you already have, okay? But in this class of signals and systems, you get an idea, you know, you come in with some function of T that's a signal coming in, might be a radio signal or whatever, and you need to do some kind of work on this signal to extract some information or something, right? And that's basically what you're doing with a radio signal. You know, you're getting a signal coming in from KUJ or whatever the radio station is you want to listen to, and you're trying to extract the information from that signal. And for you, the information is probably, you know, Rush Limbaugh or whoever's, you know, playing on KUJ. You want to hear his audio, right? So there are several, an infinite number of ways of encoding information on a radio signal, to make a radio signal. But the two most common ones, or it's actually, we kind of break the thing down into two kinds. Actually, you can do a combination of the two kinds, and it's no problem to do, you know, all kinds of stuff. But the two types that were kind of originally came up with, and are the two kind of main, you know, way of breaking down ways of encoding the information, are called amplitude modulation and frequency modulation, or you also sometimes they call it phase modulation, because you see frequency is the rate of change of phase with respect to time. So it's the same kind of thing. So you're either encoding your data somehow in the amplitude of the signal, that's how loud it is, okay? Or you're encoding it in the frequency. That's, you know, what frequency it happens to be, you know, vibrating at, or, you know, going up and down. And generally, at least in the old days, the signal that they wanted to encode was some kind of an audio signal. Or, I mean, even before that, maybe a Morse code signal. A Morse code signal was kind of some kind of a digital signal, you know, sending, you know, bits. But the audio signal that people would want to encode is stuck in the frequency range right around zero. So, you know, if you look at here's frequency and here's zero, the audio signal would be something about like this. And I'm showing you negative frequencies as well as positive frequencies, because I'm thinking of this thing right here, which you might want to call M of F. M of F are like the Fourier coefficients. M of T is Sandy Patty singing or something. And so M of F is something like this. You remember when we did complex Fourier series back in LNA, you know, you had this summation N equals minus infinity to infinity of, and we have this M of, actually I'll make this kind of like F. M of F and then E to the J 2 pi FT kind of thing. This is, you know, kind of basically what I'm saying is you make up, these are the Fourier coefficients. We had both positive and negative frequency. Make that a minus there. And so you kind of had a picture like this. This is like the Fourier, what they call the Fourier transform. You'll learn more about that in signals. But the idea is that these frequencies were down by audio. I mean, they were low frequencies. 20,000 hertz would be the maximum, you know, Sandy Patty would ever sing. And everybody had the same 20,000 hertz that they wanted to use, right? So, I mean, they could have taken Sandy Patty's signal, M of T, and just hook it up to an antenna, right? And if you just took it up to an antenna somewhere else, you could have another antenna, and you would pick that up, and you could run that right into your headphones, and you'd say, this is great, you know? Does that make sense? The problem is only one station in your range of reception, you know, could be playing a thing. And so there was this problem, right, where you have, an argument over the what's the song going to be, right? Is it Sandy Patty or is it Rush Limbaugh, right? And so what... they had that problem, and then there was this other problem, which actually they didn't really know about at first, but it turns out that in the frequencies between about, even down lower than 3 megahertz, but definitely between 3 and 30 megahertz, in the early 1900s, they found out that these signals could be heard a long ways off, like across the Atlantic Ocean.
And that was an extremely valuable thing because it cost them megabucks in the old days, you know, millions of dollars to put down the first telegraph cable from, you know, Europe to America. You know, it was like they, laid it on the ocean floor and, you know, had to be really tough. And I don't know how long it lasted, but, you know, it was a lot of money to put that down. And then in the early 1900s, they discovered this wireless thing where you could hear stations a long ways away. And what was actually happening was the signals were bouncing off what we know as the ionosphere now. It's a bunch of ions caught in the Earth's magnetic field, and they actually act like a reflector to radio signals in this range, 3 to 30 megahertz. And so you can listen, and you can hear stations from all over the world, you know. So nowadays, ham radio operators actually use that. And actually, ham radio operators were some of the, you know, first people who really discovered this. In those days, that frequency range was thought of as kind of junk spectrum. You know, the really important spectrum was down low. You know, near audio, right? That's what was really important. And these higher frequencies, they called them short waves because they were, you know, C equals F lambda. And, you know, if you make the frequency go up, the wavelength gets small, right? And so they called them short waves. And they were like, you know, that's like junk spectrum. It's not very exciting. And there were some reasons that it wasn't very exciting. One of them was the electronics. Of course, you know what happens. It's easier to make something work at audio than it is to make it work at 2 or 3 megahertz or at 30 megahertz. You know, you found out about that plugging in those components on, you know, the breadboards and stuff. So anyway, these amateurs started finding out that you could, you know, talk all over the world without a lot of power sometimes, you know. Even just a few milliwatts, you can talk all the way around the world, you know. And not always, but it depends on the, you know, the sunspots and, that, you know, the time of day. The sun ionizes this ionosphere, makes it reflect better or not. So then there was a motivation also to take the data, which was in the audio region, and somehow move it up to this shortwave region where the signals would bounce all over the world, right? And so now there's at least two motivations for trying to take that audio signal and move it somewhere. And I'm not sure, you know, who was really the first guy to do this, but, you know, one of the first guys to understand this was a guy named Armstrong. And actually, there's some interesting history if you think about read about Armstrong. He was an incredibly brilliant electrical engineer. I mean, he was just incredibly brilliant. He invented more things, you know, around the turn of the century that have been more important over the last, you know, in the 1900s than just about anybody else. I mean, you know, stuff that was like the equivalent of the light bulb and stuff. And, you know, when it came to radio, he was like the guy who invented pretty much all of it. I mean, he came up with this thing called frequency modulation. He came up with a thing called a super heterodyne receiver, which was a way of moving the frequencies, okay? And he came up with all kinds of, you know, this Armstrong oscillator and, you know, lots and lots of electronic circuits, okay? And, you know, the sad thing about him is that he was such a genius, but after he spent the first, you know, 10 years or something of his life inventing all these great things, he spent the last most of his life fighting RCA and other big companies about these patents. And he actually finally ended up committing suicide. He jumped out the window of a 10-story apartment, and, you know, and it was, you know, it was because his patent fight was looking like he lost. And what's really even sadder yet is that, you know, he actually didn't lose the patent suit either.
Oh.
You know, but you know, it kind of goes, a little bit of the moral of the story is, you know, don't be so selfish about
don't
things, you know.
Until you're sure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's okay if, you know, you don't win everything, right?
Yeah.
You know. I mean, he didn't win as big as he would have liked to, but, you know, I think his wife was well, you know, financially taken care of for the rest of her days. But it's an interesting thing. So the question is that how do you take something that has frequency components kind of near zero? Maybe we should take something less complicated than Rush Limbaugh here. And we'll just take, if you look at this, if we take just one component of Rush Limbaugh, like a cosine wave, that would be a little bit of e to the j 2 pi ft and an e to the minus j 2 pi ft. If I just took that cosine wave as my Rush Limbaugh, if it works for a cosine wave, if I can, you know, use a linearity and get, you know, the whole Rush Limbaugh if I needed to, I can send that way. So the idea is if I just took cosine omega t, or cosine 2 pi ft, how do I move it up in frequency? So let's just think about this. How can we move cosine of 2 pi ft? I'm going to call this f0t to a higher frequency. And it really doesn't even have to be higher, but in the case that they were doing, that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to move stuff low frequency up a little higher, right? So the idea is if I could move this up to like 1 megahertz, then I could have, you know, if I had between 1 and 2 megahertz, then I could have, you know, quite a number of channels in there that, you know, I could pick the station I wanted to listen to, right? That's how we kind of do it today. So actually, this is more of a mathematical question. How can you change the frequency of a sine wave by doing some kind of operation that we could actually do with electronic circuits? That's the question, really, what it is. I mean, you know, obviously we could just change this F0 to an F1. Maybe I should make this a higher frequency comma F1 here. So, I mean, if I just do that, you know, that's some kind of a processing operation. But how do you actually kind of do that? And one way to do that is to use multiplication. Now, multiplication is actually not a very easy thing to do with electronics, okay? But it's easier than taking this cosine wave, right, and changing, you know, the frequency here inside the argument, right? That's something that's going to take a lot more complicated stuff. In fact, you know, we still use this multiplication kind of thing. So remember this. Cosine of A cosine of B equals a half cosine of A plus B plus a half cosine of A minus B. So that's this trig identity. You guys kind of remember that. So if A was 2 pi F0 and B was 2 pi maybe F0 minus F1 or something, right, then I could actually, I get two components coming out here. You know, this has a frequency of A, that has a frequency of B. I get one component at A plus B and one at A minus B, right? So if you look at the spectrum, it kind of starts out like this. Here's your frequency. Here's zero right here. And now, so maybe this is FA, and here's FB, and then you got FA plus B, which is, so you got FA plus FB, and then you get one at, maybe it'd be FB minus FA, which would be kind of over here. This is FB minus FA. So you got one component here and one component there from those two components. And
You know, when I'm looking at cosine, see, cosine of A minus B is the same thing as cosine of B minus A, right? So, you know, it really doesn't matter. You know, A, cosine A and cosine B, they're how you pick those. So what happens, kind of, if I was to take this thing and multiply it by a cosine of, you know, something up here, what it would do, if I multiply it here, it would move this whole thing over by that amount this way, and it moves it over by that amount that way. In other words, if I take m of t cosine of 2 pi f, so I'm going to call it f, I'll call it FCT, would look like this in frequency. Here's frequency. Here's zero. This is the M of T over here. Okay, so it starts out at zero. So if I put in here FC right here and minus FC over here, what I end up with is a thing like this and a thing like that. They're half as tall as this guy. And, you know, one of them is moved over by FC this way, right? All of these guys right here got moved up by FC, that's this term right here. And all of the other guys got moved down by FC over this way, okay? And this is kind of satisfying because if you think about this right here, you know, when I put it back into this kind of a Fourier series here, I need the negative frequencies and the positive frequencies to end up with a real function when I'm all done. Okay? You can kind of see that here. You know, the negative frequencies are the complex conjugates of the positive frequencies. And so, you know, I end up with a thing that looks like this. And if you look at it, this is what it looks like in frequency, but if you look at it in time, it looks like this. So here's t. And this 2 pi fct, suppose over here if I do this thing in t, I guess I should draw a little picture in t here. You know, this guy is probably, I'm just going to kind of make him like this. Okay, so there it is in t. Okay. So what does it look like over here? Well, it's kind of going to do the same kind of thing. It's going to go, I'm going to kind of draw it like that. That's the envelope here, and actually it goes on both sides. Now this is just so I can draw in the real thing, okay? Because I've got to take this m of t and multiply it by cosine, okay? So what happens when I multiply by cosine 2 pi fct, that does something going back and forth really fast. So it really looks like this. And I'm supposed to stop at the dotted lines, you know. So you kind of get the picture, okay? So this is what the radio signal looks like, and this is what the audio signal. So this is m of t here, right? And this is the m of t times cosine of 2 pi fct, okay? Right. Now, the thing that they didn't like quite about this moved the frequency up just fine, but it's going to take a more complicated receiver to undo this, okay? Actually, what you can do to undo this is multiply in the receiver. If you multiply by cosine 2 pi fct again, then you'll end up with two terms like this, and one of them will bring it right back down to here, and the other one will move these guys up to a frequency of 2 fct, okay? And if you run that through a low-pass filter, then you end up with this thing back again, okay? So you can do that. It's called double sideband modulation. And it's actually, you know, not too bad as far as a really cheap and easy modulation. Yeah, well, that's a tricky thing, and that's something that Armstrong figured out. You know, it's actually not an easy question. And you can even look, there are a few now available, so you can find a few analog multiplier chips, okay? But they aren't very good. And what people normally do, instead of actually multiplying by a perfect cosine here, if you think about it, it's much easier to multiply by a switching waveform. Like, say, for example, if you took a square wave and you use that square wave to do some analog switches. So the square wave would, you know, maybe turn it on when you're supposed to multiply when cosine is up and turn it off when cosine is down or something, right? And then if you do that, actually what happens is the square wave has a Fourier series, has a fundamental and a third harmonic, fifth harmonic, and all those other things. And then if you kind of throw away or filter out all those higher frequencies, you have, in essence, this. Or, if you want to think about it, you end up with, you know, something like this with some other, you know, things dropping off way up here in high frequency. You know, they just get smaller and smaller as they go up in higher and higher frequency. So that's actually the kind of thing we actually do in electronics, to multiply by a cosine wave. Okay, that's one way. Another way is actually, it all kind of boils down to something similar to that. And they call those mixers. And there are two kinds of mixers, and you have to be careful you're not getting confused among the two. One mixer is the kind they use in the college church, which is actually adding a bunch of audio signals together. And it's just like an, inverting op-amp with many inputs kind of thing, right? It's just an addition, just adding a bunch of terms, and that's very easy to do. That's an audio mixer, but these other things are called mixers, as in what's used in radios, okay? So this thing would be nice, except it requires a complicated receiver. The receiver has to be just as complicated as the transmitter. Does that make sense? But someone came on the idea of taking this M of T, and if we could do a thing, something like this. I guess we should write here, this is called double sideband. Modulation. It's a kind of AM modulation. Requires another multiplier in the receiver. Which was costly in the early days, okay? So what they did was they came up with something that they could make a very simple receiver with. So here's what they did. They said, let's suppose M of T, magnitude of M of T is always less than 1, okay? And then we'll call this VAM of T. This is going to be the thing we're going to send. VAM of T will be 1 plus M of T times cosine of 2 pi FCT. Now, what is that going to look like? Well, it's going to look like this. Here's the T right here. And if I go back to this guy right here, instead of writing it like this, I just kind of need to offset that up by 1. Right? So it's going to look kind of like this. Okay, so now I'm going to have to write the same kind of thing down here. It's supposed to be symmetrical. I'm not very good at that. But, and then, of course, what happens is you multiply by the cosine, and it, you know, fills in like this, kind of. And this is standard amplitude modulation. This is basically the amplitude of the signal is the audio that you're looking for. And so you could kind of see what happens if we just shear off the bottom and we just take an average of what's there, we'll get back to our original thing, right? And so that's what they would do. Here's, you know, the standard. I showed you this little crystal radio thing that you could make, and this is how they made radios in the first days. You know, they would have a tuned circuit like this. Something was tuned in that, either the inductor or the capacitor or both. And then you could put across here a thing that would short out the bottom. And then you would put this to a high impedance headphone here. And there's your radio, okay? And, you know, those things do work. And they were very, very cheap to make because people would take a Quaker Oats box, you know, something like this. You've seen those round boxes. They still sometimes use them for Quaker Oats. And they would wind wire around there to make the inductor, okay? And then you could have a capacitor that, you know, you make a little capacitor that would resonate with that. And then they would use a piece of galena crystal, which is, you know, a kind of rock you can get. And then they would take a tiny little wire, which they called the cat whisker, and they'd have it on a little kind of a mount that you could adjust and touch in various different places on the galena crystal. And if you got it just right, you know, you could make this diode work really well, okay? And that was the diode, the galena crystal. And then they had some high impedance headphones, which they would listen to, you know, and they could hear, you know. And this was, you know, a pretty cheap receiver, you know. You know, a lot of the kids made them. In fact, you know, if you go over to like the old folks' home and find one of these old geezers there and talk to them, you know, there's still a lot of old guys around that have built these. You know, maybe even, I bet if you ask Carlton Cross, I bet he's built one of these, right? Yeah. So that was the solution. Now, unfortunately, if you look at the frequency spectrum of this thing, it doesn't look quite as good. And it has some bad things. Oh, I don't want to look at T. I want to look at frequency. So here's zero. Here's up here at FC. And this thing looks, it has that part. That's the M of T times cosine. And you got, of course, the same thing over here at minus FC. You know, you got this thing and that thing. That's the same as what we had here. But remember, this M of T had to be less than 1. The reason it has to be less than 1 because if this guy gets bigger than that guy, then you'll have this crossing over, right? And then when you shear off the bottom, right, and take the average of what's left, you won't get what you started with, right? Does that make sense? You know, like if I sheared this one off, I would get this. That's not right. Right? So I can't receive this with a cheap receiver now. So you had to have this 1, and the 1 had to be much bigger than the M. So the 1 makes a thing kind of like this, right there, and right there, okay? And that 1, of course, made it so you could have a cheap receiver. Now, in the days, of course, when they developed this, you know, they were willing to spend quite a bit of money on the transmitter, you know, as long as the receivers could be cheap. Because the receivers, there were millions of those, supposedly, and just a few transmitters. And the other thing that's bad about this thing is the power that you're sending out. Most of the power is right here in what they call this carrier, the 1 part, right? That's just a cosine wave at FC, right? You can see these two terms right here would give me a cosine of 2 pi fct, or 1 times that. That's the cosine of 2 pi fct. Now, there's no information in that cosine of 2 pi fct, right? And that's where most of your power is going. So, you know, if you want to fast forward to like the 1990s, when I first started teaching here, I was single, and I used to go out and help out at Adventist World Radio. And when I first went there, they showed me a brochure, an advertising brochure from a company called Brown Bavari, who makes the, you know, Cadillac of shortwave transmitters. And this brochure was talking about, you know, they're still using the same way of sending out, you know, AWR is using this, right? And their power bill was like $20,000 a month, okay? So a lot of money in power. And so, you know, when HMS Richards is taking a breath, in other words, this part right here is gone, all you see is just the those things, you're basically paying a lot of money to send no information, right? And so, you know, these bright guys got the idea, well, shoot, it doesn't take, you know, a lot of power to send silence, right? And so they would, like, turn this thing down. When HMS Richards took a breath, right, they turned the one down slowly, right? And then when HMS Richards said something, they'd quick pop it right back up, you know? And they would save, you know, about, you know, a quarter of that $20,000 every month. And so, anyway, I started bugging them to try and do that and put that circuit in, you know? And... and for one reason or other, they never got around to it. You know, there was always something that came along. And I was supposed to go down to Costa Rica. They had another transmitter station down there, and they were putting in new antennas down there. I was supposed to go down there and help them tweak their antennas to make sure they were all operating just right and whatnot. But they weren't ready for me to go down. It was Christmas break, and the engineer who was down there in Costa Rica had just been transferred down there from Guam not long before, and he'd been hassling him about this circuit, you know. And so he turned the tables on me, and he said, well, you should go to Guam and do that circuit. So I did. I went to Guam, and, you know, I never, ever had an electronics project that went so well. It was incredible because, you see, you know how it is, just before the end of spring quarter or end of some quarter, it was December, so it was end of fall quarter, and you don't have any time to do anything to work on this, any project at the end of the quarter, and I didn't know about it until about a week before I was going to go anyway. So I asked Ralph, well, just put together whatever kind of chips we've got sitting around here and give me the data sheets for them. So he went and Xeroxed a whole bunch of data books and sent me with two boxes of, you know, ICs, op amps, and whatnot. And so we went out there. And, you know, when I got there, I read their manuals and their stuff and looked at it a little more carefully, and everything just went perfectly down to the point where we needed one resistor that had to be a high-power resistor. It was like 200-watt resistor, and I needed it to put it in the screen of this tube circuit that they had. It had to dissipate 200 watts. And they had just like we have here, a bunch of these little quarter-watt resistors, right? And I'm thinking, oh, man, I don't want to even think about this. If I took all these resistors and somehow put them in series and parallel, you know, could I get this value that would dissipate 200 watts? You know, each resistor, of course, having to dissipate just the same amount, right? Oh, what a nasty problem and a disgusting thing. It's going to be looking horrible anyway. And we were all, you know, discussing this in the transmitter room, and the volunteer maintenance guy came by and he heard us complaining and whatnot. He said, oh, hey, you guys, I was at the dump yesterday and the Air Force was throwing out some stuff in brand new packages and whatnot, and I didn't know what they were, but they looked like they might be electronic stuff, so I grabbed them and I hauled them back and threw them in my locker here. Maybe there's something you can use there. So he went over, opened his locker, and he pulled out this, you know, bunch of parts, and they're like, you know, packed for World War III. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen how the Air Force packs their parts, but they're like in tin foil kind of containers. You know, with, you know, outside of that is just paper bag, and it's just like, I mean, it's like, you know, it'll last through whatever, right? And so we opened up one of these packages and the brand new things, it was the exact resistors we need, you know. We plugged that in and everything worked, and I was done with my project in less than a week. And so then I had the next 2.5 weeks or something of Christmas break to go play, and I did. And it turned out my wife now, she was there, and up till that time she thought I was a stuffy old professor. Somehow she changed her mind that during that time in Guam, and that was a great deal for me. So, you know, God worked those kind of things out, and nowadays, you know, AWR's signal goes up and down, you know, and they save, you know, quite a bit of power that way. Well, those transmitters, they've retired those. They sold them to another Christian, you know, radio station, but their transmitters now still use the same kind of an idea. You know, they used those for probably 10 years or something, and, you know, they were saving more money there on their power bill than I make here at Walla Walla. You know? But, so, you know, you got to think about this thing. Whenever you come up with a new protocol, don't think about it in the short term, because whatever you do now is liable to be around for a long time, right? Just because it's easy and cheap for you now doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be the best. Now, I don't know in this case whether they could have done anything was better, because they had this terrible cost on the receivers, right? But there's been plenty of times since that, you know, if you think about Microsoft or ASCII or some of these kind of things, right? You know, that are just kind of, they just happen to be convenient. But they have become the standard, and now they're like, you know, wasting things, right? I mean, there are a lot of instances, if you just look around, that things were not really optimized for the long term. And these protocols are something that's very important, because once you set one of these things, this is the way we do it, well, that means, hey, that's the way everybody's going to have to do it from now on, you know, and until many years hence, probably, you know, almost forever. So think about that if you're ever involved in protocols and standards. You know, you gotta think about those issues. So next day we'll talk about, you know, a little bit more about how the radio receivers work, and look at some block diagrams, and hopefully by then I'll have heard from these guys. And if you have any ideas of, you know, projects that would fit in the, you know, analog electronics realm that you'd like to work on, you know, think about that and come tell me about them, and you know, there's a fair chance we could possibly do something that, you know, you just wanted to do. So.
Question. Is this material in the electronics book, or just not?
This isn't so much in the electronics book here, what we talked about today. I think, you know, there's a lot, this is pretty general stuff, and you can find, you know, a lot of this, you know, online. There is some stuff on the wiki. If you look at the wiki, there's a lot of this kind of stuff on the wiki. For a little while here, we'll be, instead of following the book like we were really closely last quarter, mm-hmm. we'll be doing a little bit more stuff. Actually, what I usually do is I tailor it exactly as much as I can to the project. Because when you have a project, there's a certain set of stuff you need to know to do that project, right? And so pretty much all of lectures will be talking about things you need to know to make the project work. And then toward the end of the quarter, then we'll go back to the electronics book and finish up some stuff in the electronics book that we haven't yet covered. Some of the stuff you know, we'll do in here will also be in the electronics book. But this particular thing that I've talked about today, I don't think it's in there very much. And there might be a very small little bit, but not a lot. So anyway, think about it. If you have some, you know, interesting project ideas, I'm quite open to that, because, you know, at this point I haven't heard back from these Altera guys. And, you know, I think Steve's ideas for the project would be good if we can get these boards. But,
there's also, you know, there's a little bit different kind of flavor of what you learn with Steve's project versus the kind of stuff I've done in the past. Steve's project is more going to be, it's probably more similar to the kind of things you did at Embedded. When you're working with integrated circuits, you have to read the data sheet for the integrated circuit very carefully, and you have to follow the instructions very carefully about the, you know, integrated circuit and the data sheet, and it's less of a first principles kind of a thing. But there are still a lot of important and interesting things to be learned there. There's a lot of things about actually making circuit boards, and when you make the circuit board, you're actually making an electromagnetic device. You know, you actually kind of have to have electromagnetic eyeballs. You look at this thing and see, are you going to have coupling between these two wire traces or whatever? Is that going to be bad or good? And a lot of those kind of issues you have to think about, and think about them very carefully. And then there's some rules of thumb that you can follow to do that. So there's a lot of those kind of issues that would, you know, you would certainly work on. And there'd be some, in either case, there'd be some filters you need to make. And these days, a lot of stuff is using integrated circuit kind of parts, right? So I'm not opposed to doing that, but it's a little bit different, a little bit less from, you know, basics, and a little bit more higher level kind of a thing. And so, you know, I'm game if you have a project that's, you know, something, you know, in between those two or whatever, it would be fine. But if it kind of needs to be a mostly analog kind of a thing, not so much software or digital, although there could be some of both of those. But on Steve's project, we can use previously existing software and, you know, the digital FPGA code and stuff, so.
Greg, you're stretching.
Yeah, I was kind of curious. I was thinking about the set of like signal sender thingy. Why couldn't you just like do this with like a JFET or something like that? Like you have your audio signal coming in, and then like a modulated really quick sine wave, and then you use the cutoff to just get this coming out.
You can.
Wouldn't that just be the simplest?
It's actually not too bad. In fact, JFET has a squared kind of a term in it. And so if you take cosine A plus cosine B, or cosine A minus cosine B, like the VGS, that would be cosine A, and the source would be cosine B. Then when you take, you know, A minus B and you square it, you get a 2AB term in the middle, right? The cross term, and that's the one you want. So sometimes people do that. You know, and that's, you know, using a JFET, kind of a similar, you know, idea there. So... Yeah.